It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
A fun episode today.
Is it?
No, you didn't like? Okay. I want to get into it because I have my beef with it. But I want to get into it and I want to discuss.
Well, you're in luck because you're on a podcast that is literally created so that you can discuss episodes of Xena Warrior Princess. I don't know whether you were aware. Yes.
Is that where I am? Well, I like it.
In the times of brick phones, Tamagotchis, and curtain bangs, the 90s kids cried out for a badass. She was Xena, the warrior princess. The kicks, the moves, the nostalgia, the queerness. Xena made us gay.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Alice.
And you're listening to Xena Made Me Gay.
Ooh, I think it's the first time we got it right from the first try.
I think so, too. And this is the 29th episode that we have recorded.
That checks out.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you got to try something 29 times before you get it.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's start with a quickish summary of the plot.
Oh, we haven't said what episode we're discussing.
No, we didn't. We just fully didn't do it. So today we're going to be talking about season 2, episode 4. The episode is called Girls Just Wanna Have Fun.
Already in the title, you kind of sense some sexiness.
Sure. I don't know. I don't think of that song is sexy. I think of that song as like irreverent and girly.
Maybe.
And the girliness and the sexiness for me don't quite go together.
Interesting. For me, they do very much so. So
I think for me, girliness, it like has not necessarily, but it often has this infantilization aspect to it. And that obviously is not very compatible with sexiness. And plus, like, the word girls itself is, you know, it's not women. Women just want to have fun.
That is interesting. Like, I never once called myself a woman. And as you said, I'm almost 40. I always refer to myself and
I can't believe now this is not the first time you reference this, and I think not the second. I am absolutely shocked that I am the only person in your entire life who has committed the horrible sin stating a purely neutral fact of your age at one point, like 7 months ago, and I have been punished for it. I'm now the person who knows your age, guy. That weirdo. Oh my goodness.
I wouldn't say that you're punished. I would say that I'm appalled by that, but not because you said it, but because it's true. I'm appalled by the passing of time, and I fully protest. I don't know how it happened that I'm 25, but actually I'm almost 40. And thus, I've never called myself a woman. I don't think of myself as a woman. I don't think of any of my friends who are my age as women. I always say girls. What gives me peace of mind is that the girls who were like 65 to 75 at my choir in Moscow, who I sang with, also called each other girls. So I would say that I could just keep doing that. So that's why girlhood and girls are like, yeah, it's connected with sexiness because it's kind of like the only form of womanhood that I accept now, at least.
Interesting. Interesting.
I like how we are already very deep in the conversation within just the title.
Oh, God. This is going to be a 7-hour episode.
Oh, it really is.
So let's recap the plot quickly and just remind ourselves what happened. So in this episode, we start as we often do in the forest. And this forest is extra spooky. There are lots of weird camera angles, lots of filters. And generally, this episode will have a lot of both.
Yep.
We then learn that it's a Bacchae forest, which apparently is a forest that Bacchus uses to hunt for women to then turn them into Bacchae, who are like his servants and henchwomen. And if that sounds weird to you, listener, I gotta say, this episode makes some particular choices when it comes to Bacchus.
And Bacchae. Yeah.
And Bacchae also. We also then see wolves chasing someone who's wearing a familiar outfit. And we then see that it's Joxer. Apparently, the wolves are also Bacchae because they can just turn into wolves sometimes. This is never addressed again. Whatever. Apparently, it's weird that Orpheus is not there because wherever Bacchus is, Orpheus should be also because they are supposed to balance each other out somehow. I have no idea how that works and it is not explained. But then Joxer produces Orpheus's severed but talking head from a sack. So apparently what happened was that Bacchus beheaded him and then Joxer happened to be nearby. And Orpheus specifically asked him to bring his own head to Xena and ask her for help. Even though there's some beef between them because back when Xena was evil, Orpheus's wife Eurydice got caught in the crossfire or something along those lines and killed during a battle. And Orpheus still blames Xena, but he does need her help, so he's there.
Yeah, it's very interesting that we have Orpheus there as a major character, but his love story with Eurydice is actually never addressed. Like, we never know the fact, like we never talk about the fact that he went to the underworld to rescue his wife's spirit and that like he had to lead her out of there and not turn around, and she asked him to turn around and he did. Like this whole tragic story, which I think is like the most famous thing that we know about Orpheus besides that he's a musician, it's not addressed at all. That I thought that was an interesting choice.
It's not addressed, and I don't think it happens in this universe because the way they talk about Eurydice seems like there is some like chance for them to get reunited somehow.
Yes, I don't know. Like at this point, it seems that Orpheus is like fully a magical creature. He's not like a person.
No, yeah, for sure.
So maybe it did happen. I don't know. It's very unclear for me. And it's like, it's interesting that this is kind of like we forgo this part of the story.
Yes. So there's a MacGuffin this episode. Of course, you always have to have a MacGuffin. This time it's Orpheus's lyre. And we learned that it's with a friend of his. So they all go to retrieve it, only to find out that the friend has been killed, presumably by Bacchae, but the lyre is still there, so they get it. We then finally get a glimpse at Bacchus and Bacchae, and it's really not what one would expect. Like, imagine the most stereotypical devil costume.
Like, some of our listeners would know what we're talking about. Like, think Trinity the Tuck when she was playing devil.
Yes, yes.
But beefier.
Exactly. And unfortunately less gay.
Yeah.
So it's that. Like, so Bacchus is this stereotypical devil with bright red skin, giant horns. It is a choice. And then Bacchae are these super hot goth girls with their hair slicked back, pale faces, dark lipstick, and sexy matching black outfits.
I kind of love that.
It's really good. So at that point, Joxer is hanging out with Orpheus, and we learn that Joxer is dealing with a lot of internalized homophobia because he says that playing music is for sissies.
Mm-hmm. That's actually interesting to note because we know that in future seasons, we're going to meet Joxer's twin triplet brother. There are three of them. So one of the brothers that Joxer has, sorry, it's in the script, people. There are three Joxers and three Xenas. We just have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, triplets sort of kind of make sense. The fact that there's just like random people who are not just like similar to Xena, but like literally exactly the same as Xena. Like that is weird.
That is weird. True. But like Joxer has two brothers who look identical to him. And one of his brothers is basically ancient Greek Liberace or Philip Kirkorov. Like that sort of musician. And he's very obviously queer and he is very free and open about it. And I wonder if Joxer's childhood trauma stems from the fact that he had a brother who was so free and so good and so talented that Joxer was like, okay, I cannot do the things that this guy can, so music is for sissies. That's my theory.
Interesting. Maybe we can come back to that once the brother appears.
Yeah.
So while Joxer is hanging out with Orpheus, Xena and Gabrielle go into town and there's a party happening with ancient Greek hip hop music playing. And I'm not saying like, oh, it almost sort of makes you think about hip hop. No, it is hip hop. Like it's 90s hip hop with ancient Greek like theme lyrics, I think.
Yeah, and it's not like background music, like when, I don't know, we have like suspense music or like funny music playing. It's like fully what is played in this town.
Yeah, it's like a track.
Yeah.
And it, like, honestly, kind of looks like a great party.
Yeah.
So Xena goes somewhere alone and Gabrielle fully gets lured in to the dance floor by sexy Bacchae girls.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just pure lesbian fantasy shit.
Yeah, for sure.
I personally am very jealous of Gabrielle. She looks like she's having the best time. She's in some sort of trance, I think. But also, I mean, wouldn't you be? Honestly.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Xena runs into a couple of other Bacchae, fights them, and it seems that at some point one of them bites her on the neck, which Joxer notices, not the bite itself, like the moment that she's bitten, but later he sees blood and like puncture marks on her neck and obviously starts freaking out because that's how Bacchae make other Bacchae. They like turn people by biting, like the vampire shit.
Yep.
And they have like vampire fangs and everything.
They like for the purpose of this episode, like Baokai are vampires.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like,
absolutely.
There's no distinction.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Joxer tries to get Gabrielle out of the party. And Gabrielle seems very disappointed that Joxer has essentially cunt blocked her. So they leave, and Joxer keeps waiting for Xena to turn, but she seems totally all right. And we never find out why. So maybe Xena has some kind of special immunity to Baokai bites. We have no idea, and we'll never know, as far as I understand. Then Joxer, Gabrielle, and Xena go to get some dryad bones from a cemetery, and they get attacked by dryads. They fight them off, and they get the bones. And the reason all that happens is because they need the bones, because a dryad bone is the only thing that can kill.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.
Baokai.
Yeah, like, I'm going to get deeper into like the mythological stuff later, but I just want to state here that this I fully don't get.
No, it makes zero sense.
Like, dryads are tree nymphs in ancient Greek mythology. I don't know what they've got to do with Baokus or Baokai, or why their bones are sharp and they're good for killing Baokai, or why dryads are essentially flying skeletons. Like, so many questions.
Yeah, we'll get into that. So later that night, Joxer finally confronts Xena about how he thought that she was bitten, and he is finally assured that Xena's all right. But then it turns out that Gabrielle has turned into a Baokai.
Da, da, da.
How? Like, we literally never see her getting bitten. No idea. Absolutely no idea.
It could have happened in the club when she was dancing.
But like, yes, but there are no marks that we see. Mm. What, like, where? Where was she bitten?
That is an interesting question.
Okay. I'm getting some theories. I'm not mad at them.
Yep.
Anyway, there's some time pressure then, because Baokus is about to do this special ritual at midnight, where the new Baokai drink his blood and they become kind of solidified as Baokai forever. I guess now they're like trial Baokai. But drinking his blood just makes it last for eternity. It seems like. We'll talk more about that later. And then Xena and Joxer get to Baokus's lair just in time. Xena tries killing Baokus with a bone, but that doesn't work. It turns out that only a Baokai can kill Baokus. So Xena lets Gabrielle bite her and kind of turns into a Baokai visually. Like, she immediately gets the slicked back hair, a pale foundation, dark lipstick.
And fangs.
But she clearly retains her faculties, because she just immediately jumps at Baokus and kills him. And all the other Baokai seem to be in this like trance or kind of semi-drugged state, including Gabrielle. And once Baokus is killed, all the Baokai get turned into regular non-goth girls, which I found kind of disappointing. And that kind of makes me think that, like, doesn't that mean that you're going to be forever a Baokai if you drink my blood, doesn't that kind of get invalidated?
But maybe those were just new recruits.
But we do see someone drink the blood.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, then never mind.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Xena does also kill at least one or two. So maybe she kills the ones that are already, like, forever turned. Unclear.
Maybe. Yeah.
And that's essentially the end of the episode. Xena and Gabrielle go on to their next adventure, and Joxer tries joining in, but they scare him away by saying that they're going to fight Medusa next.
Yeah, that actually was a great moment for me, because, like, we're coming to the notable moments of the episode, so I want to talk more about that, because it essentially goes like this. Joxer says that, oh, where are we going next, my fellow adventurers? And Gabrielle is like, oh, Xena, yeah, where were we going? Oh, we were gonna fight Medusa, who turns men into stone with just one look. That was on our itinerary, right? And Joxer is like, oh, right, I just remembered I had a thing.
Yeah, I need to visit my mother or something like that. Yeah. That's very cute.
Aww. And, like, that being said, I want to talk more about Joxer. I want to know how you feel about Joxer, because he used to be your favorite character.
I mean, yes, when I was five.
Yeah, but how do you feel about him now? Because I changed my mind about him a little bit.
I mean, he seems like a lot more of a tragic character now to me. Like, there's all this sadness in him, and him clearly searching for community and having all this internalized homophobia, but also, I'm sure, just generally insecurities. I don't know. He just, like, he seems like a sad character to me now more than funny.
Yeah. It makes me think of one of the latest episodes of A Bit Fruity, one of our favorite podcasts. Chris told me about that, and, like, the theme was essentially, like, the sadness of this bro culture that kind of drives young men to loneliness. No. Because, like, this masculine, like, striving to be this masculine alpha male basically essentially means being very lonely in today's world. And I think that Joxer kind of suffers from that. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, like, he fails at alpha maleness extremely, I would say.
But he really wants to be an alpha male, and, like, those, like, things of, like, oh, music is for sissies is also, like, he's policing himself to be, like, this image of an alpha male.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. I guess when I think about those people, I tend to think of them as at least somewhat more successful, at least in terms of creating the facade, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas he just fails so spectacularly at every aspect of it, like the way he looks, the way he speaks, the way he behaves himself, just none of it lives up to that standard. Which, yeah. I don't know. I don't know how much of that is pure failure and how much of it is him not failing on purpose necessarily, but just also somehow not willing to do the things that would make him more conforming to that standard that he thinks he wants to attain. You know?
Yeah. I see what you mean. Like, I think it, like, in a more simplistic view of this is that the show has very, as we talked a lot about it, the show has very particular stance of, like, who is an innocent. So Joxer is an innocent in the show's regard. He never killed anyone. So, like, I think he's, like, an innocent guy who is trying to, like, make himself a killer or, like, appear to be a killer, but he's not. And, like, in the end, like, those qualities of, like, an innocent, that's what kind of draws other characters to him. And interestingly enough, is if I remember correctly, when we're going to have a bittersweet episode where they are basically, first of all singing, and second of all, every character is a tarot card. Joxer is a fool slash innocent tarot card. So that kind of ties in together.
We'll need a tarot specialist for that episode.
Yeah. So like in the end, you still kind of like the character, right?
So here's what happened. I loved him as a 5 or 6 year old because I thought he was hilarious. Then as a 20-year-old, I think I rewatched a few episodes and found him annoying. And based on those memories, I thought that I would find him annoying again. And I'm definitely not annoyed, at least not so far. I don't know how they're going to develop the character. And I do appreciate him more than I thought I would. He's a more complex character than I remembered him to be.
Cool. Because, yeah, I changed my mind about him a little bit. And I knew that I would because, yeah, when I first watched Xena, I was like 13, 14, 15. And, of course, like I found him extremely annoying. I hated him. Like, every time he went, like, I saw him on the screen, I was like, oh, Joxer again.
It probably didn't help also how much I was into him. You know, this like tiny annoying thing, like singing his songs all the time. The way that other people were annoyed about you, like being unreasonably into Caesar, maybe you were also like annoyed at me being unreasonably into Joxer.
Maybe. Like it's hard to remember at this point, perhaps. But yeah, I also do appreciate him more. So we'll see what comes next.
Yeah. So, there are a couple of quotes, from the episode that I really liked. The first one I want to read out is from the moment when we're just learning what Bakai are in this universe and how they operate. And, I think it's Gabrielle who says that, "A single bite from a Bakai can turn a young, innocent woman into a wild, soulless creature."
Yep.
Sign me up.
Basically gay propaganda.
Then, and this is already, I think, going into the what I think is going to be a long list of the candidates for the gayest moments of the episode. When Gabrielle is already turned into this trial Bakai and she's about to drink Bakai's blood, Xena finally appears at the last moment and says, "She's not interested, Bakai."
I loved it so much. Yeah,
it's so good.
It's such a clear reference to when a girl is offered a drink by some sleazy guy and God knows what is in this drink. And her lesbian girlfriend is like, "She's not interested in your sorry ass, some skedaddle." Like,
yes. It was exactly that. I really, really like that. And also at the very end of the episode, when Xena and Gabrielle are about to walk off, Gabrielle tells Xena that she's super grateful that Xena saved her life. And then she looks her in the eyes and she says, "I really want to do something to thank you." And there's this pause. And I think just the length of the pause just barely tips it over into, how exactly would you like to thank me?
Yep. Like, and at this point, and especially in this episode, we're like very clearly in the subtext world. Like, the showrunners know what they're doing. Like, it's going to get more and more. I hope we're going to get more and more of that. I don't remember completely, but here we have a lot of it.
Yeah. For sure, it's the sexiest episode so far.
Yeah, definitely.
Other notable moments and elements of the episode. Firstly, the horrible CGI is back, and we do hate to see it.
Yeah, the dryads are rough.
Oh, no. And up until that moment, they kept doing things right. And I was like, oh, this is clever. Like, I see what you're doing. And obviously, you can you can tell that it's the 90s and they have limited technology. But like, this is a clever solution. And then the dryads appear.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I had the same thought. Like, I really liked how, for example, they, like, basically Orpheus is a talking head. And sometimes it's clearly like a puppet head, and sometimes it's the actor's head. Like, for example, there is this clever trick where Joxer is holding Orpheus's head on his knees, and in truth, we just know that, like, the actor who plays Joxer just wrapped his legs around the other actor's neck.
Yeah, yeah, they just, like, draped some things around it so that it looks like
it's the talking head.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so they did some clever thing. And I actually was very happy to see Bacchus because, like, yeah, it's funny how they made him the stereotypical devil, but he actually is done pretty well. Like, he, I mean, like, the costuming and the makeup, it's seamless. Like, he is kind of scary. I just think that if they tried to create Bacchus with CGI, that would be much, much worse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, at this point, like, when they do camera tricks, and then, like,
basically practical effects. When they go for practical effects, they are great at it. And, like, honestly, in the year of our Lord 2025, that is still the case. Like, I still think that whatever practical effects movies have in them, always, always, always.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Look better than the CGI. And the over-reliance on it is sad.
Yeah, CGI started... Good CGI started and peaked with Mummy.
No, the Pirates of the Caribbean. Nope. The best CGI
it was before.
Ever. Well, no, so it...
I think the Mummy was before the Pirates of the Caribbean.
The CGI for the Mummy was good, but it peaked with Pirates of the Caribbean.
Okay, I could agree to that.
I don't think we've had better CGI than David Jones. And there's even a really long YouTube video explaining why that is the case and how the CGI workers around that time worked with the limitations and understood what they were. And by doing that, produced something extremely high quality. Whereas now it's like, oh, we can do everything. No, you can't. No, you can't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And not in those ridiculous
time frames
that make people overworked, make people cut corners because they have to. That's not the way to do it. That has been my CGI rant.
Yeah.
Another thing that I wanted to mention once again is that the ancient Greek party was absolutely lit. I want to be at that party. I really enjoyed the music. I liked the costumes. Seems like the vibes were great. just 10 out of 10 to that party. Whoever... like was in charge of making it look good deserves a lot of praise because they really excelled
Yeah, that's interesting because I think that that's kind of like the show venturing into this territory of like, we don't have to try and make a realistic ancient Greek world because we're clearly not making it that.
Yeah.
So I think that like before it was just like, oh, let's just pretend that this medieval castle is a castle in ancient Greece, doesn't matter. And now they're doing something like, I think, which is more clever. Mm. So this is an ancient Greek club with an ancient Greek hip hop track. This is an ancient Greek supermarket and an ancient Greek, like, I don't know, gift shop. Like they start to kind of introduce very modern concepts in the show, which I really love to see every time. I think it works every time. It basically is the same kind of like artistic method that Sofia Coppola uses in Marie Antoinette. Like imagine that this is just a modern girl at a club, but the setting is Versailles. So I think that that's, I don't know. I love to see it in movies and I love to see it here.
Yeah. And kind of what, Hercules, the Disney animated film was doing with, you know, like action figures of Hercules being sold.
Yeah.
So another kind of not necessarily modern thing, but a way in which Xena is doing something kind of unrealistically stylized is the fact that all of the Bacchae are wearing the same, exactly the same sexy outfit. Mm-hmm. And at some point, absolutely out of nowhere, Gabrielle also is wearing this outfit. At no point do we see like her change into it. First when she's turned, she has the slick hair, has the makeup, but she's still wearing her old clothes. And then at some point before the ceremony, she gets the sexy goth uniform that everyone else is in. And I'm like, I really want to know who makes those outfits. Does Bacchus have his own party garment line?
Design label, Bacchus, do you think he knows some shit? Like Bacchus's catacombs basically also look like a nightclub. So, yeah, I don't know. I kind of liked the... I know that it's a very transparent and kind of like goofy take of like, oh, the Bacchae are basically vampires, but I don't know, I was digging it.
Another thing that I wanted to mention, and here there's going to be a spoiler for the Christopher Nolan film Tenet. So if you don't want to hear about what happens in the film Tenet, feel free to skip a couple of minutes and you won't know. So in the movie Tenet, the climax is that some lady needs to do a certain thing to save the world. Like literally the entire world will, I don't know, stop existing if she doesn't do the thing. And she has a kid. And at some point she's like, oh no, I'm not going to do the thing. Instead, I'm going to try to save my kid. And it's like, lady, do you not see the problem here? And I feel like at some point in this episode, there's a similar thing happening where Xena is torn between trying to save Gabrielle and going after Bacchus, but she can't save Gabrielle without going after Bacchus. There's absolutely nothing she can do unless she defeats Bacchus, which will in its own save Gabrielle. And the fact that that is presented as some choice is stupid.
Luckily, we don't spend too much time in the episode on that. But yeah, I also kind of was like, where's the contradiction?
Like there's literally no choice required to be made between quote unquote saving your loved one and doing the only thing that can possibly actually save your loved one.
that was kind of like, huh?
It was weird. Hated it in Tenet, hated it in this episode.
Aw.
Then there's this, so now I'm kind of like going through my pet peeves.
Let's do it.
Shit I want to complain about. Another thing I want to complain about is that Xena actually kills a couple of Bacchae with the dryad bones, even though we later see that every single woman who was in Bacchus's lair gets turned back to normal.
Yeah.
So did Xena just, was Xena just not feeling it and was like, ugh, I could just keep fighting, you know, Hercules style and not kill any one of those, but we went through all this trouble of getting the bones. I kind of want to kill a couple just to see whether those work.
Or she needed to test them out. I don't know. Yeah, it seems weird because like sometimes we're hung up on saving the lives of like, I don't know, like some random baddies that like clearly, I don't know, are kind of like on the other side of the law, like the random baddies that want to kill you and like want to kill you willingly. Mm-hmm. And here it seems that like the girls were like innocent victims and Xena is like, ah,
yeah, what are you gonna do? Yeah. And I guess we could kind of explain it by saying that, oh, she only killed those that have been turned into these like forever Bacchae.
How would she know?
They look exactly the same. They've all been issued the same uniform from the Bacchus party collection.
Yeah.
So
yeah, this is rough.
It's strange. Another thing that bothered me was that at some point after Joxer does this internalized homophobia thing and says that playing music is for sissies, it is revealed that he himself has had lyre lessons. And that's how things are resolved in the end. They need to play the lyre to whatever.
Put Bacchae to sleep, something like that, although it does happen.
They don't go to sleep, they just suffer, and honestly, so did I, because the way he was playing the lyre was horrendous. Like, I bet if I was given a lyre, I've never touched a lyre in my entire life. I bet if I were given a lyre right now, I would produce something equally bad, if not like 10 to 15% better. And not only that, but the reason that Joxer needs to play the lyre is that Orpheus needs to sing along to it. It only works together. And Orpheus' singing is even worse.
It's horrendous. I can try to kind of like show it a little bit. It's like literally like la 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 la.
Yeah. I mean, dear listener, this is not an exaggeration. This is literally what happens. He literally goes la 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 la. Like, it's mind-boggling that they went for that. I was shooketh.
Yeah, they did Orpheus so dirty. More on that later. I want to talk more about Orpheus. He's one of my favorite characters. not in terms of like in mythology, but like in the, I don't know, cultural zeitgeist. But yeah, here it's bad. It's really bad.
It is. And the final notable moment that I want to mention is the moment when Xena first tries killing Bacchus before she becomes Bacchae or pseudo Bacchae herself. She stabs him with the bone and he falls, but then his eyes open and then he stands up completely vertically like a lever, and it just it looks kind of goofy.
It kind of looks goofy, but I think that it serves a purpose. Like, I think that this kind of movement I saw in those very old horror movies where also not a lot of CGI was used, right?
Yeah, it's kind of retro. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, goofy in a retro way. I enjoyed it. This is not actually something I'm complaining about. I just, like, I laughed.
Yeah. I like Baka, because, and I liked, well, I think we also didn't mention yet that, like, at the very end, when, like, Zina and Gabrielle already, like, are going away, we hear, like, this ha 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 ha, like, this mysterious laugh.
Yeah, so I guess he's not dead.
I mean, I think at this point we cannot kill gods yet. He just, I don't know, is appeased for now.
It's not a very appeased laugh.
No.
So all of that brings us to the major themes of this episode. And I would say that one of the most important ones that has manifested itself in a number of different ways is this, let's call it creative interpretation of ancient Greek mythology. And
yeah,
as an ancient Greek mythology nerd, I can see that you have quite a bit to tell us.
Yeah. Not exactly about the Greek mythology. I just wanted to kind of like talk about Bacchus and Bacchanalia. Like, so basically those festivities where people are, you know, running around the woods and playing instruments, singing songs, fucking, that sort of thing. And I think it kind of like plays a big part in this episode, and it plays a big part in modern culture. I'd say it became especially popular again because of The Secret History by Donna Tartt. It's a book that became like extremely popular, I would say, in the last, like, it was written a long time ago, but it became extremely popular in maybe like the last 5 years when dark academia started trending on TikTok.
Okay.
But like the Bacchanalia is a very big aspect of the book, because in The Secret History, the students try to recreate the Bacchanalia and, well, get into trouble, because I won't spoil the book for our listeners, but like, let's just say that they lose control, and in the end we're still not sure whether that was something otherworldly going on or it was just in their heads. And I think that because of that book and because it became so popular, a lot of people were like kind of like thinking about that, and like they were like trying also to recreate like the Bacchanalia lore of like with costuming and like things like that. So it's
I completely missed that.
Maybe it's just my side of the TikTok, like it's weird resurgence of that.
Interesting.
But the thing that I wanted to discuss the most actually is that even though they did Orpheus really dirty in this episode, they kind of got it right that there's the tension between Orpheus and Bacchus, which is a dichotomy wildly recognized in culture.
Oh,
for example,
okay. In
The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche talks about two opposing artistic forces.
Hello, ContraPoints. So we're going to do gay stuff and cover philosophy. Take that, is a very Natalie. We're taking over your entire niche. Sick. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is a very flattering comparison. I will take it. Nietzsche talks about the Apollonian, which represents order, logic, harmony, structure, and beauty. And we can assume that Orpheus is on this side of things, because Orpheus is often said to have learned to play the lyre from Apollo himself. And in some myths, Apollo gave Orpheus his lyre. And on the other end of the spectrum is the Dionysian, representing chaos, passion, instinct, ecstasy, intoxication, and the primal. And it's named after Dionysus, aka Bacchus, the god of wine, frenzy, and wild nature. And what actually is very interesting, like props to Nietzsche here, because
shout
he basically
out to our buddy Nietzsche.
shout out to our buddy Nietzsche for not being boring and predictable, because he basically says that modern society has become too Apollonian, like obsessed with logic, order, and the surface beauty. And this has led to a kind of spiritual sterility, and art, culture, and life itself is kind of losing its intensity. And he kind of like wants to call for a rebirth of the idea of the Dionysian, like the resurgence of this wild side of culture. So that I always thought that that was like unexpected and cool. But of course, in most modern storytelling, including this Xena episode, we still tend to see the world like in terms of like Orpheus and Apollo are the good guys and Bacchus and Dionysus are like bad.
Yeah, I mean, I was not convinced by what I saw. I saw Orpheus, a guy who cannot sing, who seems weirdly cranky and unpleasant, and who looks like he's in a shitty band with like a soul patch. And then I see all the Bacchae who are hot, love to dance, and just generally are ready to have a good time. For me, the choice is clear.
Basically, yes. But yeah, like we have to talk about Orpheus because, yeah, it was a choice to take one of the most interesting characters with one of the most saddest and greatest love stories in the world, a character who basically represents art, beauty, and the victory of art and beauty over evil, and make him like this guy with that haircut and like the goatee, or like how do you call it, the soul patch, like
yeah,
I don't know.
It's somewhere between the two, which is you know, the true uncanny valley of facial hair.
Yeah, it's horrifying. I was personally offended, like the singing was atrocious. I don't know, like I just, to redeem the image of Orpheus, I wanted to tell a story, and we're going to go in a little bit of a tangent. I was privileged to take poetry classes from Vera Pavlova, who is one of the greatest living modern Russian poets in my mind. And she asked us, why did Orpheus turn around, even though he knew that if he would, both him and his wife would stay in the underworld? And we were like, oh, well, that's a simple question. Like, we know the story. We know the morality of the story. But actually, if you think about it, I think that that's a very interesting question that kind of like goes deeply into this, I don't know, the thought process of like, what is love, and how does one let the loved ones know? And like, I don't know, I think that that's a very big poetic theme that everybody could answer for themselves. And I think that Orpheus is great, and I want to file a personal complaint in terms of how he was portrayed in this episode.
Aww. Have you not seen Portrait of a Lady on Fire?
No. Oh, is there a theme there?
Very explicitly. Like, it's in the
cool
text.
No, I need to see. I knew that it needed to see it, but that's another reason to see it, definitely.
Also, I totally forgot that Orpheus also stays in the underworld. I thought that it's Eurydice who stays, and then he has to keep going after that.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think that, like, yeah, he has to keep going, but he dies in the end, but he's, like, he's a tortured to death in the end, I think. Ew. And, like, in some, because, like, But the biggest thing that comes to mind is the opera. Like, there are a couple of operas, actually. And, like, one, I think, has a tragic ending. And one has, like, this Deus Ex Machina thing where, like, Apollo descends and is like, let me just save you and everything is going to be okay.
So another way that the Greek mythology is reinterpreted quite significantly is the fact that the Bacchae are turned essentially into vampires, as we said already. And so we might as well just talk about them as if they were straight up vampires, because vampires are often a representation of sexuality. And we do see the Bacchae as these hypersexual creatures. Also, there's a pretty strong tie to lesbianism through Carmilla, one of the early classical lesbian texts about a female vampire who...
Yeah, even earlier than Dracula, actually. So, yeah.
Is Carmilla earlier than Dracula?
I think it's famously earlier than Dracula, yeah.
Can I double check? You are correct. Carmilla is 1872, and Dracula is 1897. So there's a 25-year difference.
Yep.
But both are Irish, which is interesting. I'm sure someone who is smarter than me and knows more about Ireland than me has already thought about that and has a good answer as to why that happened. If you are that person, dear listener, feel free to reach out to us and tell us.
I also saw a big kind of like gay theme in how the vampires were portrayed, like that goes back to the title of like girls just want to have fun, and that goes back to Gabrielle dancing with very interesting characters in the ancient Greek party. Like one of the people she's dancing with like has a buzz cut and is very sexy and very cool.
Oh, she's so good looking.
Yeah, and like we kind of can assume that was one of the Bacchae, because when Gabrielle leaves, they're like just kind of like looking, I don't know, disappointed, like, oh, the prey left.
Yeah, and also, so I mean, obviously one would enter a sort of trance if dancing with two incredibly hot ladies, but I think a part of it could also be attributed to their magical powers over Gabrielle. I'm fine admitting that.
Yeah, and like I think that you could even draw some similarities in like gay accusations and like vampire accusations of like you know, like both things are about, as you said, like about desire and, I don't know, making people uncomfortable. And like there is like this sort of witch hunt of like, oh, did you see like Xena? She looked like one of those. Do you think she's one of those?
For sure.
So yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I like this episode, because Luca was very sexy and very subtext heavy.
And we haven't even talked about the most subtext-y, the sexiest moment.
Yes.
Which happens when Gabrielle turns Xena into, I don't know, a semi-Bacchae, pseudo-Bacchae.
Yeah, definitely. Because like in most, I would say that like there are some things about vampires that is just like widely agreed on. Like we know that like there were people who kind of first noticed that, and then like now it's just like text. I think it was Anne Rice maybe that kind of like wrote very explicitly about basically that the bite is the substitute for having sex in vampires. But I think that even in the earlier text, it kind of was assumed that like that's a very sensual, sexual experience. And like, I think it's definitely played that way. Like when Gabrielle bites Xena's neck, like you can see like this basically ecstasy on Xena's face.
Oh yeah,
right?
Like Xena is... enjoying the moment. And so is Gabrielle, it seems like.
Yeah, so yeah, I liked it.
no way. Yeah, and there is this weird dynamic between the Bacchae and Bacchus himself, because he's, you know, their boss, essentially. And the fact that Xena tells him she's not interested does also kind of imply that all these Bacchae are his in a variety of ways. But that never becomes the focus. And almost everything that we do see the Bakai doing is either hunting men or turning other girls or, you know, fighting people who attack them. So at least in terms of what the episode actually spends time on, we don't really get much in terms of like their relationship with Bacchus.
Yeah, I think it's like this straight dude's fantasy of like, oh, and I'm going to have a lot of lesbian girlfriends and they're going to do lesbian things to each other. That is so hot.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fantasy is more about them being bi or maybe even just like heteroflexible, but yeah, you know.
Yeah, I think there was a That's Gay episode about like, oh, we want our girls to be gay but not gay all the way.
Oh, shout out to That's Gay. I would bet that none of our listeners know what That's Gay is. If you do, please let us know, because that would be exciting. But That's Gay was a segment on a show called Infomania that aired on a channel called Current TV, all of which is completely dead and half forgotten by history at this point. And That's Gay was just like a 3-4 minute long segment by Brian Safi, who is a comedian. And that was one of the first explicitly gay non-fiction series of some sort that I had access to as a teenager. And Alice and I both were huge fans, so we still quote it to each other sometimes.
We still do, but that was so funny. Like, still, I think some of the funniest bits about, I don't know, gay topics are something that was covered on That's Gay. So, yeah.
And the last topic, I think, is not as prominent. It's only really represented by Joxer, but I think it's especially interesting given that the show relies on subtext, is the internalized homophobia that we see from Joxer when it comes to his attitude to music. I think one could read some of that into the way that he takes Gabrielle away from the Bakai she's dancing with. Even, I think, what you mentioned in terms of Joxer wondering whether Xena has become one of those could be a sign to that. Yeah. And I'm wondering whether we're going to get more of that. I think we had a little bit of just like straight out homophobia from the religious fanatics in the in the episode with the baby Carl.
Yeah,
but I think the internalized homophobia is more interesting in a way. So I'm wondering whether we're gonna get any more of that.
Yeah, me too. That's an interesting topic. In terms of Joxer, the only thing that comes to mind is that, not about internalized homophobia, but just in terms of him being like clueless and unaware or in denial in general, I think that Xena's friends kind of like, there are two groups and like some of them completely understand what's going on. Like Solmonius, for example, you said that like as soon as he's like, oh, you have a friend, he says, and like he completely gets the nature of the relationship. Autolycus, I think, at the very beginning has a crush on Xena, but then he quickly realizes that Xena has a girlfriend and it's Gabrielle. And now he's just like this, like, straight dude who they're both friends with, and like they have a very sweet relationship, but he's like not even trying to go there anymore because he's like, well, that's clearly like they're together. And I think Joxer remains like he is with them the most. He's like one of the characters that's featured the most in the show, but he remains absolutely clueless till the very end, I think.
Oh, baby boy. I'm very curious to check that. I will be on the lookout for things that prove or disprove what you just said.
Okay, cool.
And all of that brings us to the fun credits for the episode, which are kind of their standard boring version. It says, no blood-sucking Bacchae were harmed during the production of this motion picture. However, a few dryads lost their heads. And now it's going to be a tough one, I think, to pick. But what was the gayest moment of the episode?
Ooh, yeah, a lot of things to choose from. I would say that Gabrielle dancing with gorgeous Bacchae was the gayest moment for me. Like, it's not about Gabrielle and Xena, but like the way they danced, it was clearly a gay club and lesbians just having a great time dancing together. And then Joxer is like, oh, Gabrielle, I think that's this kind of club. We should leave immediately.
Yeah, very much so. I'm going to go for Gabrielle biting Xena's neck and both of them having a great time. And really taking their time with the bite. Like, you could just, you know, bite someone and say, no, they're relishing it. They're letting it take as long as it pleases them. And it pleases them quite a bit.
Yeah. Actually, it pleases them quite a bit. And actually, it's perfect that you mentioned this moment because I have a question just for this episode. Just like my poetry teacher, I'm going to ask, why do you think Xena let Gabrielle bite her? And why did she retain her sensibility and could fight off Bacchus? Because I think that it's left ambiguous in the episode and we can kind of
speculate,
think of our own versions. Speculate, yeah.
Well, okay, so the boring answer is Xena let Gabrielle bite her because she knew she wouldn't turn fully and she knew that she needed to be like at least somewhat Bacchae esque in order to kill him. And the reason she retained her faculties was that she's a demigod. Those are the boring answers. Mm-hmm. And they might be the correct answers, but, you know, just thought we would get those out of the way. Getting into less likely but more fun versions. I think a part of Xena wanted to be bitten by Gabrielle. She was like, when else would I get a chance?
Yeah.
I don't know. Do we ever see any ancient Greek drugs? I'm not sure we see any ancient Greek drugs. Well, I guess we saw ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca and the mushrooms that...
Red. Yes. The henbane. But I don't know, maybe in part this is like Xena felt like having a mind-altering experience. Just like, let's have some fun with this. What are your theories?
Yeah, I would kind of go into, I would speculate that I agree with you that Xena kind of wanted Gabrielle to bite her because basically this turning into Bacchae, as it's shown, it's kind of like letting your desires in. And here it kind of like seems that it's kind of like the ultimate desire of like, let's just be who we are, aka to people who are very horny for each other.
Aww.
And I even think that one of the explanations of why Xena then was able to kind of like go and kill Bacchus, and actually Gabrielle jumped and like was kind of like right there with her. She also jumps towards Bacchus as if she wants to kind of like hurt him. So it just seems that them being reunited or like reunited through this vampire kiss kind of like they become so dangerous and self-sufficient being together that they're like they become stronger than the spell that Bacchus cast on all the Bacchae.
Yeah, the way Neo and Trinity together have the power to break the Matrix.
Yeah.
And that just leaves the final question, which is how many chakrams out of 10 would you give this episode?
I like this episode. I would have given it an 8, but I am deducting 1 point for Orpheus being such a hot mess.
So
a 7.
A 7. I am very conflicted. I think that in terms of plot holes, this was an incredibly weak episode, but it was very sexy. And so I am hesitating between 5 and 6.
Okay.
But I'm looking at the previous episode, which was Giant Killer, and I see that I gave that one a 5. And Giant Killer was not sexy.
No.
So I think it is my duty to rate it higher than Giant Killer. Just
makes sense.
As a gesture of respect and appreciation for sexiness. So a 6 for me.
Okay. So 7 and a 6.
Exactly. And that concludes our discussion of episode 4 of season 2. We'll soon be back to discuss episode 5 of season 2, which is called The Return of Callisto.
Wonder what happens in this one.
It's really unclear. So, you know, I'm just approaching it with an open mind. And whatever they end up doing in that episode, I'm sure it will be something.
All right. Until then, please give us your reviews wherever you listen to podcasts. And you could even find us on Instagram at Xena Made Me Gay and drop us a line or a comment. We would be very, very happy.
We would be. And until then, have fun. And we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.